Can't fire me until you pay me. Hello and welcome to episode 187 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we have a courtroom banter about whether a film is a masterpiece or not. I am Nick, the country lawyer of this podcast, and I am joined as ever by Roger.
I guess I will sober up anytime now, really. Just need a reason.
Now, we, not so long ago, watched Otto Preminger's Laura, and we rather liked it. So this was obviously we were going to like it. It was a noir film from the 50s, or late 40s. Yeah. So we thought we'd watch another Otto Preminger film, and me being something of a fan of Jimmy Stewart, I suggested Anatomy of a Murder. So that is what we've decided to watch. It's a long film for a night. This is 1959, and it is a nearly 3 hour long film, which is almost unheard of for a, I can't remember seeing a film that long. There were some early, silent movies that were quite long, but I don't remember seeing a talkie from the 50s, that was 3 hours long.
Yeah, this is, 160 official running time. Surprised me too. I don't think I've met anything else of this length. If I did, I didn't notice. But honestly, I didn't notice this until I realised, hang on a minute, it hasn't ended. They're not winding up. I'm still enjoying it.
Yeah. yes, I will say, as a clue to how we felt about it, it didn't feel like a desperately long film. Again, this is my happy place. I, probably more than you, I just like Jimmy Stewart. I just watched it. We've seen some films with him in that we didn't like, particularly the Hitchcock films.
I think the filter at this point is Jimmy Stewart in black and white, not at Christmas.
So that worked for you. The last filter doesn't apply to me, but it worked well. So this is there had been courtroom dramas before, but this was a courtroom drama written by an actual ex courtroom. I don't think, was he a judge?
He was a Michigan Supreme Court justice, so that's the state Supreme Court. John D. Volker.
But he decided he wanted to write the story of a murder just as it happened, as it happened to him.
So yeah, he was the defense attorney in the case that this was based on.
He was the Jimmy Stewart character.
Yeah.
So he sort of decided to do that. Then he picked a murder, which I'm not sure is criteria. It seemed representative to him. He just wanted to show, it was like, I'm sick of all these Hollywood things. Here's how it actually happens. And so this is, we had a lot of courtroom dramas, but I think I'm right in saying this is the first one where we actually go through all the procedural steps.
Yeah, I gather that this does get used in teaching law students in relevant bits of the state, simply because it has all the steps of arrest and arraignment and so on.
Now, I have seen this replicate. There was I loved it actually. There was a TV show called Murder One, and it was like a long 24 episode season back when they used to do those, and it was just one murder case, and it went through the selection of the lawyer. There was a whole episode just on jury selection. This seemed relatively short in comparison, but I'm sure that TV show was influenced by this, because this, again, it goes through the selection of the lawyer. The crime's already been committed. We never see the crime being committed, not so much as a flashback. We don't get anything other than really Paulie. So Paulie is this ex-district attorney who has been...
He is Paul Beigler, but everybody calls him Polly.
He is a district attorney that has lost his seat because they're elected in America.
It's never made clear why, but, he has clearly lost a lot of business as well.
Yes, and it's clearly, kind of bored and given up, and is just happy to go out fishing. Which again, I think is not dissimilar to the writer of the books.
You are sidling around the Duke Ellington in the room, because this is 1959, and I will. Early Duke Ellington, it's great. when he was basically making music that people would get up and dance to.
Yes.
That was great stuff. That was many years before this, and at some point somebody told him, Duke, you can do no wrong. Just sit down at the piano and vomit out whatever you want to, and it will be great. And he believed them.
Right, I see. Now, this is what I was going to say. There is a jazz legend in this film. You may be a fan of jazz. I am not.
I'm not a fan of this style of jazz.
Okay, well, this is exactly
he does appear on screen
of...
as well as doing the title music and the most of the soundtrack.
Yes, he does. There is a lot of jazz soundtrack in this film. I managed to get past it, but I don't enjoy it.
Yeah, the interstitial music, I didn't love it, but I think it did its job. The titles were really distracting for me.
Well, I had actually, with this film, I had actually watched the titles sometime before. So when I went back to watch it again, I was sort of already 5 minutes in. So I didn't go through the title. They feel like very kind of proto-60s kind of, I don't know. Yeah, I agree. I don't think they fit the story particularly at all. They just felt like if you had to pick some random titles from the 60s, they would have looked a bit like this.
Yeah, also, it's 1959, we want modern happening music. This is modern happening music.
And of course, so we have to have Polly being quite, despite appearing quite stiff, he does actually sit at the piano and play with Duke Ellington at one point in the film.
he is listening to jazz and playing it at home in between his fishing trips. The thing that occurs to me, I'm not sure I can say this is a failure of the film, but it threw me slightly. I mean, I knew this is Jimmy Stewart, black and white, Otto Preminger. Mm. I was frankly expecting something more noir than what we got.
And I see what you mean. Okay.
I'd just like to touch on that as we go through the plot.
That's fair. I think that might be... Because I don't know that the film leads you into that. I agree we've come off the back of Laura. But actually, I went into this knowing it was a real murder case. And so I wasn't expecting particularly convoluted story.
Yeah.
So that might be why we had different expectations here.
Yeah, I hadn't read about that beforehand.
Well, it's good to go into a film fresh. So you were slightly wrong. Well, we can talk about this as we get.
Yeah,
so,
but anyway, he is quite happy drinking his remaining money away with his alcoholic ex-lawyer buddy.
Yes, yeah. Who's again? You get the idea. They were both their stars are fading. They were both something more than what they are now.
Yeah,
but
the is it Parnell McCarthy?
Yes. His chum.
He is clearly of a previous generation, but...
He's very close to being a comedy Irish drunk person, but he doesn't have the accent, but he is very close to that. So there are some things in this film that are of its time. There are quite a few things that were ahead of its time, though, I must say.
There is a moment where somebody smokes in the courtroom, and it's not just that he's smoking in the courtroom. He has an extremely long cigarette with some kind of bulge in the middle.
Yes, I don't know what's going on there. We have a murder, and we have Polly is phoned by the wife of a murderer. Basically, a lieutenant has been arrested for going into a bar... and shooting someone dead 5 times. It's never in any doubt that he did it. He went in there. There were loads of witnesses. He shot someone dead. He went out again. So the murder, it's not there's no mystery here. There's no confusion. There's no,
And he said that he did it because the guy raped his wife.
Yes. And that's already in the papers. Which is interesting because they dance around it a lot in the trial, but I guess that is already known to Polly when he goes to visit it. But the wife phones Polly and asks him to go and visit the guy, and he decides to take this murder trial largely because he's got no money, and so he needs some money. It turns out the lieutenant who did the murder has got no money either. So this is Frederick Mannion.
But he can get some.
He can get some.
As long as he's not in prison.
Yeah, as long as I get out, I'll do an IOU, and I'll sort it out for you. So Polly goes for it. And then we go through the murder. So we have
This is where the my noir expectations led me astray, because first we meet the wife, who is a young Lee Remick. This is not her first film, but it was very definitely the one that brought her to fame. And she is a classic noir woman. She is not quite rubbing herself all over the lawyer, but she would be if she thought she could get away with it.
She's not far off. She would flirt with a paving slab. She's this kind of, she's very femme fatale. Now you could, I wonder, does it make me uncomfortable about the portrayal of women? I don't think it does here, because I think what it does is open up this kind of misogynist thing that comes up in the trial, that, you know, she was asking for it. And so it creates some interesting discussion. Like Polly basically says, you're not coming into the trial dressed like that. You have to be in all tweed, wear glasses, tie your hair up in a bun, put a hat on top of the bun. Do not come into the courtroom looking like you are sexually available or sexually interested.
It is never entirely clear, because all we have to go on is what people say. But certainly I think one interpretation is that she has occasionally, perhaps, been sleeping with other men. Yes. And while from a modern viewpoint we would say, yeah, even the local good time girl gets to say no if she wants to say no, that would not be the attitude of the era.
No. And it's kind of unspoken. But yes, the suggestion, she may even have slept with it. And there are suggestions that it may not even have been a rape. It may have been consensual.
Yeah, and this is why there are things that were said in this film that were not said on film at the time.
Exactly. So we get into, well, we can talk about that sort of later in, but yes, it leads to all manner of quite explicit discussions about rape. So Polly goes to meet the lieutenant, who is clearly knew what he was doing. Again, we never find out. Well, this is what I like about this film. A lot of what I like about this film is the ambiguity. It's not entirely clear whether it was a rape. It's not entirely, the facts are not in question. He went in and shot someone. And what I kind of like about this film is there's no moral judgment on Polly's part. He's actually not really interested in why it happened. He's not even particularly, because he never asks particularly, he's not even really interested, was it a rape or not? He just immediately is taking the angles that are going to get his client off. So, okay, this had to have been a rape, because then we can say you went temporarily insane. So immediately, he's not actually interested whether his client was insane or not. He's just behaving professionally as a lawyer with no moral judgment. And I like that, because it's very different how we see lawyers depicted one way or another. He's just being professional. And he's like, okay, the best plan here, given this situation, is that you were insane. Let's go and prove that.
Yeah, there is what one of the film's two great procedural flaws here, which is that he is clearly coaching his client, and he does it no matter which witness coaching as well.
Yes, I don't know that that's a flaw so much as that's the sort of thing that went on, and he knows my reading of that was he knew he shouldn't be doing that, but if the lieutenant doesn't say anything, he doesn't say anything, well, that's just, the reason I think is that because he's not very explicit about it. He kind of says, well, I suggest you rethink, you know, how you're going to plead, and you might want to go and see this army psychologist. I didn't feel that was a flaw so much as, yes, highly illegal witness leading. But I liked it. I liked that was the angle they took.
Now, is another thing that caught me, misled me in the early parts of the film, because we don't find out about all the witnesses to the shooting until a little bit later.
Mm.
And my immediate thought following the noir pattern was either she lied about the rape in order to get him to shoot the guy because she didn't like him for some other reason, like maybe he turned her down, or she shot him herself and caused him to think that he had shot him in revenge.
You should not come into this film with a knives out style mindset, I guess, because there are no spoilers. There's no real twists or turns in the plot. What we are told at the beginning
the twists are what is done in the courtroom, as opposed to suddenly we discover.
There's a very few surprises, but the fundamental facts of the case do not change in the whole film.
Yeah.
But I do understand if you're going into this thinking this is going to have some twists and turns, then you will be slightly surprised. So we have him interviewing the witness, and we have Ben Gazzaro. So Lee Remick, I think, is amazing as a femme fatale. She's really, you can see why, you know, she gets Jimmy Stewart hot under the collar, and he's trying to be professional, and she just seemingly can't help flirting. And then we have Ben Gazzara, and he's an interesting character because he's not very sympathetic. He's pretty cold. He's pretty angry. He's clearly quite jealous. He's actually quite an unpleasant character in a lot of ways.
And clearly thinking way more than he's saying.
Yes, exactly. There is a lot going on in there, but you can tell he's very thoughtful about what actually comes out of his mouth. And the whole time they're trying to say, well, he lost control of his emotions. But you never see any evidence of that really in the character of the man. And I quite like that it is disturbing. And Jimmy Stewart's character is not, again, he's not curious about that intellectually. He's just, I'm sure he has his own thoughts about, actually, are we doing the right thing getting this guy off? But it never enters his mind in a professional sense, because he's got to get, that's his job. He's got to do the best he can for his client.
I got a certain amount of same sort of feeling as Anthony Perkins in Psycho the next year. That very contained, very do not scratch the surface, you would not like what you find sort of young man.
Except we don't have that Psycho ending where we get the psychologist. We don't have that yet. Ben Gazzara,
this is his second film, incidentally. He's done a lot of stage work before.
He is a Ribbon of Memes alumnus because he was Jackie Treehorn in The Big Lebowski. I did not recognise him at all, but there we are. He's very good here as a lot of this film is. I really like this kind of ambiguous grey area because it just feels real to me. This feels how things actually happen, which is how I like it. The one character perhaps that doesn't work well with that, and I think we slightly discussed this off air, I think he's Jimmy Stewart himself.
Mm. And I think it doesn't help that we don't know why he lost the election.
Yes.
We meet the guy who beat him in the election, who is clearly incompetent, the new DA.
Yes.
Fair enough. But, you know, was there some scandal? Was there some thing that he just didn't do as well? Did he lose his taste for the fight? In which case, why does he get back the taste of the fight now?
Mm.
There's just a slight gap in his characterization for me, which is why I was for quite a while wondering, is he supposed to be the slightly naive country lawyer falling for this woman?
Yes.
Or is he actually trying to lead her on to get her to betray herself?
Yes, is he like a patsy? I think partly that is just because it's James Stewart and you're so used to seeing him as these, well, you know, yeah. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington style, morally. I'm not arguing. I love watching Jimmy Stewart, and I do like him here. But I wonder if maybe a better character actor would have done an even better job.
Just developing the character a bit more beyond, you know, taste in jazz, likes to hang out with his alky buddy.
Yes, exactly. They're slightly. On the one hand, he's a super duper hotshot lawyer. On the other hand, he's and they, you know, you can mesh those two, but I don't think it quite works here. But anyway, I think everyone else who are less well-known actors at this point, I feel like they are upping their acting game a bit. And James Stewart doesn't have to, because he's just really being called on to be James Stewart, I'm happy with. But
there is one key bit of casting which I think audiences at the time would have been very aware of, which I was not aware of as I watched it. I found out when I was reading about it later. Judge Weaver.
Yes.
He's played by Joseph Welch, who was an actual lawyer.
I recognised that voice, you know.
He was the chief counsel for the US Army in the Army McCarthy hearings. He was the guy. Basically, he was the first guy to seriously take on McCarthy and say, Have you no sense of decency?
Oh my God. And having known that, I now love him. I mean, he's a great character in it as well. But oh my God, that's one of my favourite historical clips of all time. I should have recognised the voice.
But he's doing a very good job here of being a properly disinterested, in the sense that people don't use anymore, judge.
Yes, exactly. He's doing his best. So he is a replacement judge, because the judge that they know, that the prosecution and defence both know, is ill. And so he's a replacement. He's come down from some other court. He's very good, as you say, disinterested, in the sense of he just wants justice to be done. He has got no other skin in the game, and he's doing his best. The number of objections and sustains and all that thing, is that how it actually works in the US court?
It depends on the court, it depends on the judge. It's very dramatised. There are several times when he says, if you do this again, you will be sorry, and then they do it again.
So, exactly, yeah. It does fit. The problem there is he does make him look slightly weaker than he needs to because of all this objection.
It's definitely theatrics. I mean, so we have on the other side the DA who is clearly incompetent, and in order to make it a fight, we get the guy from... is it the state? What is it?
Yes.
Basically, the Attorney General's office sends someone to competent. Who is George C. Scott?
I mean, if you're going to have an opponent, General Patton is the one to go for. yes, a very young George C. Scott. And he's quite... he's very underplayed here, but I mean, he's a brilliant actor, so, you know, it works really well.
I think his job is basically to be the dark mirror of Beagler. He is prepared to do just as much of the way of shenanigans on his side.
Slightly too much, I think, as we'll
come back to that. But for most of his time, that is what makes it a genuine fight rather than Beagler running rings around his replacement, which is obviously what he would do.
It would do, because yes, the current DA is not much. So I mean, we go through jury selection, first time that had ever been seen on film, where it's interesting, because I guess I remember watching not the O.J. Simpson trial, but a documentary, and that went on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Well, yeah, I think the procedures changed. Basically, at this point, there are standard bars for it.
Yes.
As they go through, you know, are you related to any of the people involved in the case? That kind of thing. You don't have the thing that you would have later where either side's counsel can object to specific jurors.
Yes, which leads to days and days of jury selection. And even here, the judge is like, I've never seen that done in half a day. But I guess what I didn't realise at the time of the, and I think it's changed again since, is that very bloated O.J. Simpson trial was an aberration. That is not how murder trials used to be. They used to be much shorter and more succinct, like we see here.
Well, this is a thing that it is important for me as a fictional crime fan. I don't really do true crime for complicated reasons. To remember that most real murder trials are frankly simple.
Yes, exactly. Because most murders are not the work of criminal masterminds generally.
A and B were having a beef. They'd been shoving each other all evening. Then A beat B to death.
Yeah.
All their mates saw it. Yeah.
That sort of thing. Yes. Well, as here, really. I mean, there's no question about whether a murder has been committed. But
there is no question of whether a killing has been committed.
Correct.
At one point talk about taking a manslaughter plea bargain.
Well, so Paulie and his alcoholic mate do some research, and they're a bit stymied because the lieutenant's gone to the psychologist, who has come up with this idea that, he felt an irresistible impulse to kill the man. And that knackers them, because what they want in the eyes of the law is he was unaware of whether he was committing right or wrong. And there is no, the doctor says there's no question about it. He did know right from wrong, but it wouldn't have mattered because he felt this impulse to do it anyway.
Yeah, part of the consideration is that you know, she got back, she told him, he took some time to, you know, think about what to do, load his gun, go out there, shoot the guy, rather than just running out immediately, which would look more plausibly like temporary insanity.
Yes, whereas this is clearly premeditated. So they bash the books and they find this precedent from the late 19th century that in one case, irresistible impulse, whether or not right or wrong was known. And I love this like little reset, the boring bit that lawyers have to do, reading through precedent and working out. Again, it's all dramatised because you don't see the hours and hours and hours of failed research. But I think it gets the point across. Mm. They find that there is a precedent that you can use irresistible impulse, or at least it has been used before as a cause of insanity. And then we go to, we start moving into the trial proper. And this is probably a good hour and a half, 2 hours of this quite long film is in the courtroom. And then we basically just follow it through. And at no point do we ever get a kind of objective truth. And again, that's what I really like, that everything is all Polly is having to assume and make supposition and grill the witnesses. And, you know, when it gets near a truth that he doesn't want, just as George C. Scott's character, he tries to move it away from that because he's not interested in that. I guess I was slightly surprised that the characters who are barely in this film is the jury. You just see them in the background and they aren't characters at all. My assumption there is we're supposed to be the jury here. We're supposed to be the ones watching the film and deciding.
I'm reminded of the series Crown Court, which was on when I was a kid.
Mm.
And that the basic approach they took there was to put the camera in effect where the jury would be and say, here are all the arguments, here is the interview with witnesses and so on. And then towards the end, you decide, and then you find out what the actual jury decided.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's kind of where we're being led with the film, because you see them slightly in the background, but not much.
Also, I think from Beadler's perspective, and I think this is largely from Beadler's perspective, they are not really, I mean, they are tools to be manipulated much more than they are people he would get
characters,
to know.
Yeah.
Now, a different style of lawyer might well say, well, okay, you know, we have three young women, I will do stuff that will appeal to the young women.
Yes.
But that's not the style he has here.
That feels like more modern, but it probably isn't. But yes, as you say, it's not the style. So right at the start of the trial, we have the medical examiner giving evidence, and this must have, like, this was during the motion picture code, though it was one of the things we've talked about a few films that started to kill the motion picture code. Well, this was one of them.
This is the same year as Some Like It Hot.
Yes, exactly. But here, I mean, this is like, it's a really clinical description of rape. You know, they are talking about, you know, did you find any, I don't think they use the word semen, but basically they're saying, did you find any evidence of a sexual act being committed? And they talk about coming to sexual completion and spermatogenesis. These are just words that you would not have believed to have heard in the cinema before.
Again, a film of the time, the next year we get Psycho, and that is the first time a toilet has been shown on screen.
Okay, that's nuts, isn't it? But so, yeah, there's this really, basically what they're trying to find out is, what did she have sex? And was there evidence that she was raped? It really goes into some detail about what they talk about her panties. There's a discussion about the amusingness of the word panties and how they have to get that out of the way because it's actually going to become a key thing in the trial. Did anyone find these undergarments?
Yeah, and the question of they were missing when she got home. Were they lost? Were they ripped off at the scene, or was she not wearing any in the first place?
I know that there's this whole section where George C. Scott is basically getting at, are you the kind of person that would go out to a bar without any knickers on? You know, it's just,
it's chucky enough that she's not wearing a girdle. So
exactly. And you know, he doesn't quite go into that, but the whole kind of misogynist implications of basically, well, then you were asking for it, weren't you? And I don't know. Well, the film doesn't really sort of have an opinion on that. I just felt it was, again, those attitudes are quite dated, but it's not explicit. I just felt it was realistic to me that that is exactly the sort of thing lawyers would get at, because, you know, George C. Scott is trying to show she's this kind of person. It's happened before.
But also, another of the things I like is that by the time it's over and the jury retires, neither side is feeling confident of victory.
Yes, it's not.
There hasn't been one of those great big, you know, the jury will applaud your closing speech moments.
Well, we don't even see the closing speeches. I was surprised at that. So we get to the closest we get to a shock horror moment is that Polly has done some investigation, or his drunk friend has done some investigation, and found out that the woman who lives in the bar.
What hotel?
In the hotel.
It's a hotel with bar and restaurant.
Yes, exactly. So she lived there with the murder victim, who also sounds like a pretty unpleasant character, to be honest. No one comes out of this well, but I've forgotten his name now, but the one who got shot.
Quill.
Quill. So George sees, he has found out that he's her dad, but the prosecution has not discovered this, and so he is trying to imply that there's an improper relationship between her and Quill, and you know, there's this whole scene where he's trying to push it and show that she had a relationship with Quill, and he was right, and she eventually says that he's my dad, and it, you know, his whole case falls flat, and you see George C. Scott's face disappear, and it's almost a moment where he seems like he's lost the case, but it's not quite, because it ultimately, that's not got a lot of bearing on the actual thing, which is was he insane at the time of shooting?
Yeah, it's a setback, and this is made explicit early on, where Dancer objects to something, and the judge says that's sustained. The jury will disregard that last remark, and Manny and the client says to our hero, "How can the jury disregard that remark? Well, they can't. That's
yeah,
the point."
That was a nice moment. That was basically, you can see all these games they play to get people to say stuff, which then gets struck, but they know it's still hit a chord. We also have, you know, the doctor, the army psychologist comes and gives evidence. And that's when Dancer knows he's in trouble, because he can see there is a way that the jury might believe that, the Lieutenant Mannion was insane. And that's when he pulls this stunt, which, I think for both of us pulled us out of the film a bit. Which is where he gets a cellmate from the night before from Mannion to come up on the witness stand.
Yeah, now we have seen one of the few things that isn't part of Beagle's viewpoint that we have seen in the film, that said cellmate made a suggestive comment about the gorgeousness of Mannion's wife, and Mannion beat him up a bit for it.
Yeah, so there's no love lost between them.
But then he says on the stand that Mannion had been saying, "Oh yeah, I got it made. I fooled them into thinking I was insane," and so on.
And it's clearly, I mean, he's a bad actor. I don't mean the actor is a bad actor. I mean, he's a good actor in the sense that he portrays a terrible actor. He's clearly lying.
Yeah,
that would be my opinion, that the film doesn't show that. But
and the first thing that Beagler does is fully establish the criminal record that he glanced over in passing.
Lied about.
and then gets him to admit that they were all taken up to the prosecution office, and it was suggested that if they had anything bad to say about Mannion, they could say it.
And this I find less forgivable as a break of procedure.
The thing is, Dancer, as we have seen him, is the expert tactician.
Mm.
And this is something that you might be able to make it not blatantly illegal if you dressed it up as a plea bargain sort of thing, but
It's pretty iffy, even so, even by the loosest procedure rules. And frankly, Dancer does not strike me as the sort of person who would do a thing that could backfire in that way.
Exactly, yeah.
He has respect for his opponent.
I think it is too obvious to the point, it's so obvious to the audience, it would be beyond obvious to the judge what's happened there. I agree. That does break the character a bit. Again, this is based on an actual murder trial, and they did use some of the actual court transcripts in the script. Whether this actually happened, I don't know, but
I haven't read the original case.
I might read the book now, I'd be interested. But it doesn't matter in a way, because in the context of the film, as Dancer has been established, you're just like, what? Why would he do that? That's nuts. He could go to prison for that, and he's not that desperate. It doesn't really work.
Though even that is not, again, there is no, the jury is clearly entirely on our side now moment.
Yes. So yeah, I wouldn't have been surprised either way. So then they retire, they wait for the jury to, so we see the kind of tension after the trial, where we missed out, you know, there is some jealousy. You can see that Mannion is starting to get jealous of the lawyer, of Polly, because his wife is flirting with him as well, because she can't help it. And
he's longer than his wife, of course she will flirt with him.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there's all these hints of, you know, there is clearly a history here, there are things that aren't being said that probably have been, in fact, there have been, you know, beatings in the past from jealousy. None of it is kind of dug into by Polly, because it is not going to help his case, and frankly, he doesn't want to know. And I don't know, there's no kind of moral judgment there. It just is what it is. And I think that is the nub of why I like the film, really. It's not that I feel things shouldn't have moral judgment. I just felt like this felt real to me, in the sense this is people doing their job. He has got a job to defend this guy who is, frankly, probably wasn't insane at the time of murder, and it probably was a cold-blooded murder.
I think that's what the ending is trying to say, because at the end, our heroes go to the trailer park to get the IOU signed.
And he's buggered off.
The Mannions have decamped.
With her crying in tow.
Leaving a note that he was feeling an irresistible impulse.
Yes.
That says to me, yep, I managed to fool you two, ha ha.
Yes.
I do feel that this is not quite as bad a situation as it's portrayed, because they must have had, in order for Bigler to represent him in court, a contract.
Mm.
And therefore he could go to the army and say, look, this guy owes me money. But
yes, I agree that is what the ending should, but it's not played as a kind of a, you know, dolly zoom, oh my God moment. It is just like a, oh well.
They're not devastated. They're not perhaps even terribly surprised.
Yes. And it is clear that they're going to get some work off the back of the publicity of the whole murder trial anyway.
Starting with administering the victim's estate on behalf of the daughter.
Exactly. So it's sort of a happy, you know, it sort of has a happy ending. Polly won. But, you know, on reflection, you're thinking, but should he have got away with it? Should it? What was, I'm going ad nauseum, but I just like that it wasn't your standard Hollywood, this is an innocent man. Oh no, he wasn't innocent. You never really know. You just have to, and because of that, it leaves this kind of uncomfortable feeling of, okay, I guess justice was done, maybe, or was it?
Well, looking at the historical case, which was not at the Big Bay Tavern, it was at the Lumberjack Tavern, a block down.
Yeah, they filmed it very close to where the actual murder happened.
The couple were divorced soon after the trial.
Mm-hmm.
They did have a daughter at some point. I suspect they had the daughter already, but she isn't in this, of course.
Right.
Who later sued the makers of the film for depicting her parents in a bad light and completely failed.
Okay. I think she said it was too close to the mark or something.
I don't think you get to do that in libel law. The truth is usually defence. But anyway.
I do believe they used exactly that defence of irresistible impulse yes. in the original case as well.
And I believe the citation is a correct one.
Okay.
It's not a thing that was commonly used. California actually abolished it in 2002. I don't know what other places may have done. It has also been described, or a variant of it has been described, and I think it makes it clearer as the policeman at the elbow test. It's not a question of whether you knew what you were doing. If you had been aware that there was a policeman at your elbow ready to arrest you, would you still have done it?
Okay. And if you would have done, then you're not guilty.
Then you can argue irresistible impulse and temporary insanity.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because also, you know, that when you know a bit about psychology and psychology, you know, it's all just opinion and, you know.
Well, there's also the consideration of, well, yeah, you were driven to murder once. Could you be driven to murder again?
Yes.
Which is one of the things that Dancer brings up, in fact.
It's a whole, I find this fascinating because that pretty soon into this, you get into the, you know, do we even have free will? What counts as actually an action that you consciously decided to do? You could argue we haven't actually, we're not even conscious at all. We just think we are. Pretty soon you get into the point of, is there even a point of punishing people for their actions because nobody is actually responsible for anything they do? It's all predetermined.
One of the considerations is we do not want people getting murdered.
Yes.
And so obviously, yeah, the man who, the classic example here, he is henpecked for decades and finally kills his wife, or she is beaten up for decades and finally kills her husband. They are unlikely to kill somebody else.
Yes.
But there is still the societal point that murder is not tolerated.
Well, this is so there's a difference between protection of society and accountability for your actions, you know, and the justice system is supposed to deal with both of those. When you get to the tricky issue of actually nobody's really accountable, and I think there's some good scientific evidence that actually none of us really have free will at all, and we just think we do. I suppose I take the attitude, well, if I think I've got free will, that's probably good enough for me because I'm not going to worry too much about it. But, you know, there comes a point where, and this, the insanity thing deals with that really. Okay, there are some situations where you couldn't have done but what you did. But isn't that the case with everything we do all the time? Anyway, I'm just rambling now, but I find those questions fascinating because our whole justice system is based around, yes, protection of society, but yeah, people should be accountable for their actions. Otherwise, insanity wouldn't be a thing. It wouldn't matter.
It's also a multi-way thing, you know, and what one of the purposes of imprisonment, depending on who's running it at the time, can be, we get this person into a position where they do not feel the need to commit the crime that they committed.
Yes, again. Yeah, so that's, yes, it's protection as well. Anyway, I find it fascinating. I find the whole thing slightly uncomfortable. It's a bit, you know, you're seeing the sausage is made, you're seeing how justice is done, and it is not like the Hollywood film, even though this is a Hollywood film. It's people doing their job, and it leaves a slightly uncomfortable taste in the mouth. People could have walked away from that trial thinking he got away with murder, literally got away with murder, he shouldn't have done it. Other people could have come away thinking, well, that was fair. He clearly was insane. And there's no right or wrong
possibly
answer.
I would have done that too. I couldn't have stopped myself either.
Exactly. I thought it was great. For me, all those questions got me thinking a lot about it. It had some flaws, I agree. There were some bits that pulled me out of it. For me, though, to have that film at that time, and yes, it is a little dated, but so ahead of its time in many ways, for me, that is a masterpiece in the sense that it was clearly highly influential on a lot of future courtroom films. It was influential, as you say, because it's used as training for lawyers, or at least was at some point, whether it is now.
Well, not exactly as training, but just as a, here is another way of getting this particular thing. And it is an enjoyable film to watch as well. I don't think anybody's saying this is what you should do. They're just saying here are the stages that it goes through.
If you want to know the procedure, this is a very quick summary of them. I think, personally for me, it's a masterpiece. It helps, it's black and white, it has James Stewart, Otto Preminger, It's 2 for 2 for me with Otto Preminger. He knocked it out of the park with Laura. This is a very different film. It's not noir, but it is great. I loved it.
Yeah, this was nominated for 6 Academy Awards. Didn't win any of them.
Oh, there we go, good.
But this was the year that Ben-Hur won it, won basically everything, so...
Okay, yeah. This is a better film than Ben. Well, it's a very different film than Ben-Hur.
I felt much less trepidation going in to watch this than I would feel about watching Ben-Hur, which I've never seen and have no special intention of seeing.
I have to say, I've never seen Ben-Hur either, but I feel the same as you. We probably won't be doing it for whatever it means, but you never know. You never know.
Well, I mean, in theory, if we go back to do earlier years as we'd planned to.
Yeah, we may do. We haven't done any sort of swords and sandals. Not for a while, anyway. But let's not talk ourselves into doing that.
it's not a real sword and sandal film unless it comes from Italy and everybody on the screen is delivering the dialogue in Italian and being dubbed later often by somebody else.
Except for the one American they've got in to do it.
Who's still trying to deliver it in Italian and dubbing later.
Well, that is case closed for this episode.
I don't think I could dignify this film with any more questions. We'll be right back.